Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to start a conversation about the United States Constitution. This started, actually, for me many years back, but recently there were two articles in the New York Times, one which quoted David Law and got us thinking about this again. We the People, Losers Appeal with People Around the World. And Sanford Levinson's at work as well, who wrote a piece on the imbecile Constitution. They join us both now. Sandy Levinson is professor of law and government at the University of Texas in Austin. He wrote the book Undemocratic Constitution and framed America's 51 constitutions and the crisis of governance. As I said, wrote the op-ed piece Imbecile Constitution recently. And David Law, professor of law and professor of political science at Washington University Law School. And Sandy and David, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
This, in some ways, is emotionally, viscerally dangerous territory to trot upon, because the Constitution, Sandy, is looked upon in America with almost kind of spiritual reverence as some kind of God-given document that we should never tamper with. Sandy?
Yes. That's certainly right. That has become part of America's general culture, I think, particularly since World War II. But interestingly enough, it's also a more or less official part of Mormon theology. So I'm genuinely curious, for example, as to what Mitt Romney thinks of the Constitution and whether he would be capable of taking a more analytic and detached view of it. I think, though, it's also worth comparing the attitude that Americans have to the national Constitution, which is one of, I think, undue reverence, with their feelings about their state constitutions. Most Americans, I suspect, don't even really realize they live under state constitutions, and those who do rarely have any reverence for them. In fact, each state has an average of three different constitutions over their histories. And I really do wish that we looked at the national constitution with the degree of detachment that most Americans have about their state constitution.
Now, before I bring David into the conversation, you mentioned the Mormon reverence the Constitution as a religious document in the short article you wrote for the Times, the op-ed. What do we know about what President Barack Obama, as a constitutional law professor, has written about the Constitution and its viability for the modern era? Do we know anything about that?
I think the quick and dirty answer is no, because he's an extraordinarily eloquent writer, but except for a relatively tossed-off comment in 2008 where he said, we really have a great constitution and we should adhere to it, when he was attacking, I believe, Sarah Palin for her views on suspension of habeas corpus, he has never really written anything extensive on the Constitution. I assume that, like most Americans, he thinks well of it. I assume, as a practicing politician, he's not going to go out on a limb and say the sorts of things that academics or even that Justice Ginsburg was willing to say about the Constitution. But there really is no evidence, much one way or the other.
And David Law, the study you did, that was fascinating to me. I've always been one to say in my conversations with people in this country and around the globe that one of the things that inspired people across the globe is American democracy, is the notion, the broad kind of undefined notions of freedom and liberty and individual rights. And that kind of is a spark that really did hit the world, I think, for the last 100 years. But when you look specifically at what our Constitution is saying to the world, that's a different matter.
Right, right. Well, I wouldn't say, it depends on how general you want to be. People certainly haven't given up on democracy. They might not have the American implementation of democracy, right, with three branches of government and, bicameral legislature and so on and so forth. And they haven't given up on some of the major features of the American Constitution. They haven't given up on judicial review. They haven't given up on the very idea of having a written constitution, one that's entrenched against formal change, one that contains the Bill of Rights. But what other countries have done over the last two centuries plus is they've taken the ball and run with it in ways that we haven't. It would be as if people still use stereos, but generally, well, actually, that's not a great example. People sometimes do use vacuum tubes, but we've moved on, right? We have different ways of doing those tasks that do a better job of responding to current needs, make use of the wisdom of experience, whereas ours is still somewhat fixed in the sort of late 18th century time warp.
Yeah, but I can jump in for a second.
Please do, Sandy.
On this, one of the reasons in the new book that I spend a fair amount of time on state constitutions is that if you realize there are 51 constitutions in the United States and not only the United States Constitution, then you discover that among those 51 constitutions, the United States Constitution is by some significant measure the least democratic, partly because to a remarkable extent it continues to be the Constitution drafted in 1787. If you compare the United States Constitution with most constitutions written after World War II, the United States Constitution is significantly undemocratic. So when we try to say that part of what America is about, and presidents from Woodrow Wilson to George W. Bush to Barack Obama now have all said that part of our role in the world is to spread democracy, we ought to have a discussion that we're not having about whether the United States Constitution itself and the American national government could pass a 21st century definition of democracy. What I find is that a lot of the people who don't like my books tell me, altogether accurately, incidentally, they're not wrong, that the people who wrote the Constitution were deeply mistrustful of little d democracy, and what they wanted was a republican form of government. And a republican form of government in 18th century language is one designed quite deliberately to minimize what they feared as the excesses of democracy. For better or worse, we live in a very different world, but we really have not been willing to scrutinize the 18th century Constitution in terms of our 21st century expectations of what we mean by a democratic society.
Well, I mean, let's take that for a minute. I mean, one of the things that three different parts here. I mean, starting with something that David Law, that your study kind of talked about, when the world looks at the American Constitution in some ways as an arcane document, a document that was written for the 18th century and the early 19th century, that, you know, even as you know, Thomas Jefferson was quoted in an article. Thomas Jefferson said, let me just read this kind of quote from Thomas Jefferson I always loved, which is that some men look at a constitution with sanctimonious reverence and deem them like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched, who ascribe to them of the preceding age as a wisdom more than human and suppose what they did to be beyond amendment. Let us follow no such example, weakly believe that one generation is not as capable as another of taking care of itself and of ordering its own affairs. Each generation is as independent as the one preceding as that was of all which had gone before. And we're talking about somebody who didn't necessarily agree with the Hamiltonian vision of a stronger Republican government until he was president a little bit. But when you look at that, I mean, so talk about that in terms of our Constitution, as some would see it, as an arcane document.
Right. So, first of all, I'm not saying that other countries actually follow Jefferson's advice, but it so turns out that the average lifespan of a formal constitution is, in fact, 19 years, which is the period of time that Jefferson argued should elapse between the revisions of the Constitution. So, as a matter of practical experience, 2 decades is about right. And it may be, you know, you can patch up constitutions like a car, right? Supposed to get you from point A to point B, you can patch it up to keep it running, but whatever the expected lifespan of the Constitution is, we're well past the recommended service interval, right? This is something that's badly in need of an overhaul. But as Sandy's touched upon, it's very difficult to fix up, to do what you need to do with this document that's meant to be a working blueprint for working government if you put it on a pedestal and you make it a sacred text. So we backed ourselves in the corner and we can't do what we need to do with the document. So when this is a document that's old, you really have only two options. You can fix it formally through the amendment process, or you can fix it informally. So formally through the amendment process, as Sandy pointed out, we have basically the hardest constitution to amend in the world. And it's formal amendments have been largely about starting. I mean, it took 2 centuries just to agree on the pay raise amendment, which was utterly uncontroversial, right? So this is not a great amendment for the future. The other alternative is you can amend it informally, which in practice means you can use statutes, administrative regulations, or most visibly for law professors, at least judicial interpretation. But then you run into a different problem, which is that we criticize our judges for engaging in counter-majoritarian lawmaking. Right? How dare those 9 justices in a row make up our constitutional law? So they, and understandably, feel conflicted about this, and that contemplates itself out of judicial positions. On the one hand, we have this amendment, this constitution refused to update formally. On the other hand, we attack our judges when they dare to say that it is their role to fix it up. And so that's a recipe for disingenuous behavior, where the justices do, in fact, do their own version of updating, but aren't honest about what they're doing, and or dysfunction, where the document simply no longer reflects or meets our current needs.
I think that's useful, especially for your listeners who are from New York, to realize that New York, depending on your meta theory, is either on its 4th or its 5th constitution.
Right.
Because there were a lot of fundamental changes in 1938, and so there are some people who would argue that they were so fundamental, it really is a brand new constitution, and other people who would say, well, there were only very important amendments to the, I think it was 1894 constitution. But everybody in the world agrees that New York has had at least 4 constitutions, and many people would say 5. Now, part of the reason is that the New York Constitution contains a provision that I'm a big fan of, which is that I think every 20 years, New York electors are given an option to vote yay or nay on having a new state constitutional convention. And interestingly enough, the New York Times, the last time this was up, I think was in 2008 or so, but the New York Times wrote an editorial saying that it would be a good idea to have a new state constitutional convention because it's been a long time since 1938, and the New York state government is significantly dysfunctional in a number of ways. And so the New York Times wasn't shocked by the idea that the people of New York should license the convention really to ask, to what extent is this a good document for the 21st century? The reason I mention this is not only to contrast the New York Constitution with the United States Constitution, which of course includes no such provision, but the New York Times has written some, you know, almost over-the-top editorials denouncing the very idea that we might think of a new constitutional convention at the national level. Even the Times, by then, when all is said and done, to a mixture of veneration for the national constitution that they certainly don't have in the New York Constitution, and also just an absolute fear of what might happen if we had a new national convention. And I think that one of the most important realities of contemporary American politics is the extent to which both the right and the left really and truly fear the other side, and it may be that centrists fear both, but I don't think, and I think this is really a very scary thing about contemporary politics, I don't think there's a feeling among most Americans that you can have productive conversations with people with whom you fundamentally disagree. And so better that we kick the can down the road, that we deny that we're facing some really very serious political crises of governance and just keep telling ourselves, well, we've gotten through these problems in the past. We did, after all, win World War II. And I think that's a very dangerous kind of denial. But I do think at the national level, it's just part of the way we look at politics and the Constitution. As I say, it's very, very different from discussions about state constitutions, where people are much more sober.
And Mark, at the risk, may I say something at the risk of sounding a little too cynical about what happens when you have a constitution that's 225 years old and counting? Again, at the risk of sounding too cynical, you could almost divide up the provisions of the current federal constitution in three categories. There's the obsolete category, where it's so old that it no longer even describes what we actually do, and just to get the document to reflect our actual practice, much less make things better, would take some work. So, for example, political parties, the administrative state, these are foundations of how our government actually operates. No mention of them at all in the document. Most constitutions do provide, have at least mentioned, acknowledge the role of the bureaucracy, the role of political parties, and then they go on to say things like, you know, maybe the Constitutional Court has the power to review whether a party's destructive foundation is made. Maybe you have campaign finance or public finance, but you can't have any of those things if you don't even acknowledge the existence of the building blocks of American democracy, so political parties, administrative states. So we have a document that doesn't even reflect reality. So that's the first category. Second category provisions, so you've got the obsolete provisions. Second, you've got the controversial provisions. And third, you've got the arbitrary provisions. So the controversial provisions, those are the ones that in some sense still work, but the reason they work is because they're open textured and we fight over them, right? So the due process clause, the equal protection clause. So you've got things that don't describe reality anymore, obviously. You've got things that are still alive, but they're still alive because they're so fuzzy that they mean whatever people want to make of them. And the third category is you've got these arbitrary rules that are the equivalent of when we drive on the right-hand side of the road to the left-hand side of the road. They're almost pure coordination rules. Even there, the Constitution does not do a great job. Like, for instance, the natural born citizen requirement to become president, right? At 35 years of age, you have to be a natural born citizen. The natural born citizen requirement is terrible. It creates two classes of Americans. Or how about the dates when federal officials take office? The initial draft of the Constitution created a royal method that constitutional amendments necessary and still not fixed, as Sandy pointed out. So even the arbitrary provisions of the Constitution, the ones that are the equivalent of traffic rules, even those don't work so terribly well. So you've got obsolete provisions that are still relevant, but it's because we don't know what they mean, and provisions that are arbitrary, and not only are they arbitrary, but we could probably do a better job, I would say.
Yeah, I think David is absolutely right. I think not only are political parties the best single example for this thesis, but you look at the Federal Reserve Board, that every modern economy, for better and sometimes for worse, has a central bank. And one of the reasons to have central banks, frankly, is because we don't trust elected political leaders to be sufficiently above the fray when they make decisions about things like interest rates or money supply and the like. A number of post-World War II constitutions acknowledge central banks. We don't.
Yes.
And you actually have some serious or semi-serious people who say that the Federal Reserve Board is not merely a bad idea, but that it's unconstitutional. But I also want to pick up on David's second category, because one of the major themes of my new book called Framed is to try to distinguish between what I call the Constitution of Conversation and the Constitution of Settlement. The Constitution of Conversation is what law professors obsess about because it is what is litigated and what we can debate about. And David is absolutely right. Equal Protection Clause, due process are the very best examples. We really don't have any firm idea of the one true meaning of them, so that, you know, we litigate, we shout at one another, the court comes up with decisions that time B can be very different from time A, and you can make an argument that, you know, we get along reasonably well with this kind of conversational constitution. But the other part of the Constitution that is really the focus of this new book is what I call the Constitution of Settlement. And law professors especially, both David and I are also political scientists, law professors do a terrible job of teaching the Constitution of Settlement because there's nothing to debate about in the way lawyers debate. That is, what does it mean? We know what 35 means. We know what each state gets two senators means. We know that what January 20th, which is the very stupid inauguration day we have for new presidents. So we don't shout at one another about what this means. We ought to be discussing, well, is this wise or not? But lawyers and law professors, frankly, aren't really that into debates about the wisdom of certain parts of the Constitution because they're so completely obsessed with debates about meaning of things like equal protection or freedom of speech and the like. Political scientists, I think, are more interested in the structures. And you know, I think that's what we should be debating at least as vigorously as the one true meaning of the Equal Protection Clause.
One of the things that I'm thinking about, that I was looking at some of the constitutions from around the world, India and South Africa, Canada, in preparation for our short conversation today. And a lot of the newer constitutions spend a great deal more time talking about human rights than our Constitution does. I mean, this is something that's a 20th century phenomenon, and that
right.
New constitutions grab a hold of, and even kind of harkens back to FDR's before he died, when he called for a second Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
what he said he would push in his
right.
last term. So that to me, David, is significant.
Yeah, and what's interesting is you want an example, I think, of what FDR would have wanted in a second Bill of Rights. You can actually kind of look at the Japanese Constitution, because that came at this moment in history before the start of the Cold War, after the end of the Second World War, to the last gasp of New Deal liberalism. It's as if there was sort of this constitutional escape pod from the United States and it landed in Japan and germinated there. And no sooner did that happen than the Cold War kicked in and became paranoid. And we didn't want to guarantee things like labor rights and the right to healthy living conditions, the sorts of things that, you know, the supposedly American-authored Constitution, right, in Japan actually contained. So there is this inexorable tendency to what we call rights, where the growth in the it's like inflation. Okay? Constitutions have a certain form of inflation. They only add rights over time. Prices go up. Bills of rights become longer. The only country in the world now, and the only Western industrialized country that doesn't have a Bill of Rights is Australia. So things get added, and the types of rights that are added, we've seen three waves of rights. You know, there's initial waves, which are sort of the classic American negative liberty, freedom from the government, right? Civil and political freedom. Then there's a so-called second generation of rights, which are positive rights, the right to education, the right to health. And, you know, let's not overstate, though, in practice, the difference between the United States and other countries. In practice, we have a lot of these rights. We do have, you know, universal public education. We do have some form of health care for the public. We just don't have the written constitution.
Right, right.
And then there's third way. So partly, you know, one of the things that would need to be done if you wanted a more workable constitution to affect reality is you'd want to put in the constitution something we already have. Right? The parties, the administrative state, the central bank, the various social welfare rights. Social Security is effectively constitutional in a small sense. I mean, good luck amending the Social Security Act, right, in any meaningful way. And then there's this third wave of rights, which is these are the so-called socioeconomic group rights. The group rights. And these might be a little harder for Americans to swallow, I think, given American ideology, individualism, the idea that you single out particular groups, particular protection. I mean, you know, the Civil War amendments were supposed to help African Americans, and they haven't always panned out that way. So, you know, we don't have a great history with the notion of group rights.
Right.
Let me
go ahead, Sam.
Jump in for a moment. You know, David's typology is absolutely right, but I think that one of the costs of the degree to which we, and by we, I mean people who teach law, people who write about law, either professionally or, you know, pundits, public commentators and the like, because they always focus only on the United States Constitution, they miss the fact that every single state constitution does guarantee the right to a public education.
Right.
And a number of state constitutions actually go beyond education. So it's just not true to say that Americans don't believe in any positive constitutional rights. What is true is that for a variety of reasons, ranging from the fact that the Constitution was drafted in 1787 and is very difficult to amend, to the fact that a lot of Americans remain mistrustful of the national government, but are willing to allow their state governments a great degree of latitude. So one of the debates that I think we're going to hear over and over again over the next several months is, why is Romney Care perfectly constitutional and perfectly all right, but Obamacare is the end of civilization as we know it?
Let me ask you both this question. On the heels of that, Sandy, and maybe you could just, we can kind of conclude this way, because what I thought about was that two things. One is that, you know, we have right now people who are pushing in Congress for a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United, that gives the individual rights power to corporations. One of the things that people fear, I think, is that the power, if we start rewriting our Constitution, who's going to do the rewriting, and where's the power come from to do that? And in some ways, it's wrapped around, as you were describing, in many ways, in Lynn's new book, where he talks about the Hamiltonian Jefferson divide in America. I mean, that is the divide. I mean, because the visceral passion comes from the Jeffersonian side. Let's do it in the States, but the practical way this country was grown and built was a Hamiltonian side, and those factors together put us in a situation that I don't know how we work our way out of.
Using Hamilton Jefferson makes it sound maybe a little prettier than it is, right? I mean, even more brutal. those on the left fear that the Tea Party is going to rewrite the Constitution. Those on the right fear that the readership of the New York Times is going to rewrite the Constitution, the cosmopolitan left. But, you know, what is the alternative? The alternative is we just don't take responsibility for our own Constitution. You know, yeah, there's a bottle there at Pandora's. I mean, a box, there's Pandora's box, you open it, you don't really know exactly what's going to come out. But the alternative is terrible, and it runs, this is the irony. We invented the practice of written constitutionalism, of getting together, thinking about how our government should be run, putting it down on paper, vowing to live by it, right? And we are the ones who don't practice it, at least at the federal level. We did it once, 225 years ago, now we don't want to do it anymore because it's a sacred text. It's a horrible irony. And so our refusal to revisit the Constitution is contrary to the very principles on which the Constitution is founded. If we don't want to take responsibility anymore for our government, if we want to leave it to the nine justices or to the people who died 200 years ago, then let's at least be honest about that. Right now, we're not even candid about what we're doing. We haven't even recognized our failure to take responsibility for the Constitution or our betrayal of the very concept of creating a Constitution to live under.
Yep,
Sandy, go ahead.
Agree with David. I would emphasize there have been over 230 state constitutional conventions, and certainly people who are scared to death of a national constitutional convention might at least study some of the state constitutional conventions, some of which worked, some of which didn't, but to see if there are any useful, what James Madison called, lessons of experience to be gained from those. The other thing, and maybe this is just an illustration of the principle that if you're going to hang for a lamb, you may as well hang for a sheep, that when people say, okay, Levinson, you say you want a new constitutional convention, how in the world would we get delegates to that? Well, the answer I now genuinely defend, really believe,
is that the best way to get delegates is basically to choose that to choose them the way we choose juries. That is more or less at random. And I say more or less because I would have some modest geographical distribution requirements. There would have to be age limits. But by and large, I would pick, let us say, 700 Americans, good and true. I would pay them for 2 years the salary that a United States senator or a member of the United States Supreme Court gets. I would give them a budget that would allow them to hold hearings all over the United States and all over the world. This would become the ultimate, frankly, in reality television. And at the end of the 2 years, see what proposals they have and submit it for popular ratification. We're not really talking about rocket science, frankly. We're talking about basic differences in values, basic differences in risk preferences. How scared are you of bad legislation so that in order to try to prevent the bad legislation that terrifies you, you like a system that also means that lots of good legislation will never get anywhere? Or how much are you willing to say, well, you know, I'll take my chances in getting some bad legislation because at least we'll get some good legislation we need? So you don't have to be a rocket scientist to debate this. And I think that the most Jeffersonian side of me, and I'm not a Jeffersonian in Michael Lynn's sense, I'm not a huge proponent of returning government to the local level, et cetera, but what I have discovered is that the Jeffersonian side of me is that I still maintain what may be a naive faith in our fellow citizens, including members of the Tea Party, including members, you know, of groups that I really do not affiliate with, to think that if we got together under these sorts of circumstances, we were going to be together for a long time and we were going to debate out ideas, and it was not only Tea Party and Occupy people. One virtue of a random selection is that you get a broad cross-section of American public, most of whom are neither Tea Party nor Occupy, and see what happens. I'm willing to roll the dice with that. I know that other people I've talked to are so scared of people, by and large, they don't know, but they identify as kind of a capital O other, that they want no part of this kind of democratic politics.
I thank both of you. Sandy Levinson is professor of law and government at the University of Texas, Austin. His book, Undemocratic Constitution and America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, wrote the op-ed piece, The Imbecile Constitution, in the New York Times. David Law is professor of law and professor of political science at Washington University Law School and co-author of the study that inspired the other op-ed that we referred to, We the People Loses Appeal with People Around the World. He co-authored the study, Declining Influence of the U.S. Constitution. And I want to thank both of you, David and Sandy, for joining us. This has been just an incredibly interesting discussion.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we return, we'll be joined by some Tibetan monks who are visiting Baltimore. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.